Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Renowned jazz artist Wynton Marsalis. His prolific career has resulted in a wide breadth of music. Everything from big band swing to jazzed up versions of nursery rhymes made just for kids. This weekend, the Wynton Marsalis Quintet comes to the Boston Symphony Hall. Ahead of their performance, we checked in with Wynton Marsalis, who's also the managing and artistic director for jazz at Lincoln Center and the leader of its orchestra. We began by asking him how he's grown as a musician since he first came to Boston at age 17.
When I first came, I was 17. I had no sense, really, of first the breadth and depth of jazz, let alone symphonic music and the different experiences that I had, the students I met there. And to be a part of the tradition of Tanglewood and the Boston Symphony, and it is a great trumpet tradition with Armando Guitala and Roger Voisin, and to meet other great musicians in the Boston Symphony. And at that time, Gunther Schuller was conducting and running the Berkshire Music Center. He became a mentor of mine. I learned all kinds of things from him. I played under Bernstein there. We played Prokofiev Fifth. I met trumpet players and colleagues that I have to this day. Just it was such a new world, and Tanglewood was a place of such quality and so many great musicians, and it's a great tradition which goes all the way back to Koussevitzky and Bartok and the music he wrote and the conducting workshops. I could go on and on and on, and the impact it had on me as a musician and a student, understanding what serious musicianship was about. And not that I didn't know that, because my father's a musician and somebody who is a teacher and studied and played and believed in practicing and all those things. So I grew up around serious musicians. But to see a lot of younger musicians really serious about playing and to meet that range of people was a defining point in my life.
Let's forward now in your career. You've been incredibly prolific, released a wide range of recordings. You've done classical compositions. There was a stretch where you produced... In 1999, something like 10 records in a single year. And then there was a stretch around 2010 for a while where you didn't record a lot. What accounts for the kinds of ebbs and flows for you of that? I don't want to say productivity, because I suspect that you were plenty productive. You just weren't recording as much during that time.
Well, I've always been recording, so we just haven't put records out. So all through 2010, 11, 12, we're making recordings the whole time. As a matter of fact, now we're in the process of releasing 100 records in 5 years.
So, oh, my gosh.
We've released six already this year. And I think we released Betty Carter, Buddy Bolden, a piece called Swing Symphony that we did with the St. Louis Symphony, Jazz and Art of our large orchestra, with arrangements we did inspired by great artists, American artists. Jazz for Kids, which we just put out, has nursery rhymes and songs with new, fresh arrangements, different kind of look at music we all know, everything from Itsy Bitsy Spider. To The Wheels on the Bus Go Round and Round. We have a Christmas album coming out called Big Band Holidays 2, because we had another very successful Christmas album. And at the top of this year, we're going to release a piece by Sherman Irby, Inferno, Wayne Shorter, a great album we did with him. Then in February, we're going to release Duke Ellington's Black, Brown, and Beige, and a new piece that I wrote called The Ever Funky Lowdown. And it's going to go on and on. So for the next 5 years, we're going to be nothing but absolute productivity the entire time.
And what made you decide to do it that way, record for a long time and then release for a long time?
Well, I just go with what the opportunities are, and what is, the recordings are less commercial products for me than they are statements of our art and where it is. Not just me, all of us now end up dealing with our orchestra, Jazz and Lincoln Center Orchestra. We work on a lot of music together. We have 10 arrangers, so we produce a lot of music in a very short time. And some years we've done 8, 9 original shows of music that never existed. So
incredible.
If you put the fact that we've been working together basically 20-something years, you have a sense of how much music we actually have and new music. So And I was also waiting just for the time that I felt the culture needed for us to be very definitive. And I think that this is a point, this is time for us to be extremely definitive.
What do you mean by the culture needs you to be very definitive?
We all have an umbilical cord that we're attached to. And it's very easy for you to get so caught up in your own magnificence that you lose sight of that cord. People who are in my age, it's interesting age for us because that's when your parents start to pass away and, you know, you start to experience things you really didn't think of. And you start to question things, fundamental things like what is home? If your mother passes away, your father passes away, it's something you may have taken for granted that was central to who you are as a person. When you get into the age when that begins to happen, or you start to have grandchildren, or you start to consider very fundamental things in a very primal and active way. So a culture has to do that also. Nations have to do that. And we are certainly at that point in our country where we've lost sight of who we are.
You have been critical in the recent past about current African-American music, some pieces of hip-hop and rap. And earlier, you mentioned to me the importance of this cultural moment and of the definitiveness that you want from at least your music, if not jazz, in this moment. Can you talk a little more about that?
As a citizen, I'm critical of many things in our culture, and I always feel free to express it. I have said it from the beginning. Words like all these things that are commonplace, I'm categorically against that. I don't like it. I never liked it. And I'm from the hood, so I don't need a credential from somebody born in 1985. I will continue to say it, not just about that. That does not also mean that I support other things that are against people just because they're black, or that I'm blind to American racism or any of the things that plague us. The simplistic view of the world that robs citizens of their right to make nuanced and considered points of view is also a thing that I'm critical of. And when I'm speaking, I'm not trying to speak from any perspective of looking to garner favor with any group of people. I try to speak from my experience, and I try to be honest about my feelings. And I maintain the ideas that I've expressed about the use of these type of pejorative terms or the buffoonery of reducing black people to being fools. I'm not for that.
Does the practice of jazz and the presence of jazz offer an opportunity to reunite, to bring people back together in collaboration and improvisation at a time when we need it?
It does, but it's an earned collaboration. You understand that a part of your critique is also yourself. So if I'm critiquing something in our culture, I have to also critique myself. And when you collaborate with other people, other people's expertise and knowledge helps you also to define yourself. And it's important when jazz teaches you to respect how much other people know, how creative another person is, whether you agree with them or not. Because we can come around the common goal of swinging, the things we want to do are subsumed by our search for common ground. And if that common ground is serious, hey, you could come up with something. But as Jelly Roll Martin, the great first composing intellectual of jazz, observed when he was in the Tenderloin District of New Orleans, you saw all kind of people there because it didn't really take a credential to be down at the bottom. So people can come together to go up high, or they can go down low and find each other too.
Let's listen specifically to a piece of music. This is Blue Twirl off of Jazz and Art. Us through the definitive in this piece. What is the statement you're making or the cultural moment you're capturing in a piece like this?
First, that's a piece composed by Vincent Gardner, great trombonist in the Jazz Lincoln Center Orchestra, also is the artistic director of Jazz Houston, a nonprofit organization that supports jazz education and performance in Houston. That piece was inspired by Sam Gilliam's artwork. And it uses a progression of a standard song, but it has many time shifts, and we use elements of like Sam's way of putting paint on the canvas, and some sections are really abstract with us making different type of sounds and a low bass cue, and then we go into a progression and a swing. And Vince's music is always very layered. He always uses a lot of pyramids and kind of interlocking parts that sometimes are 30-second notes apart. So it's like, it'd be like 8 horns playing that one line. And his music is arranging is very colorful. Probably the greatest arrangement any of us have played is Vincent's arrangement of Thelonious Monk's Light Blue. And that's one that we play for years. And whenever we hear it, we always say, man, we don't know how he heard that one. We just put out on Jazz for Kids, Vince has a recording of Rubber Ducky. That's one of the hardest damn arrangements to play. Boy, I must have practiced my part, just the layering of the parts, because the melody of Rubber Ducky is in a pep section a la Duke Ellington. I think if Duke heard it, he'd say, damn, is that how he heard? He has all kind of underlying contrapuntal lines. And if you play the original Rubber Ducky, you'll see what Vincent Gardner does with his arrangements.
I love it that you have enough respect for what music can bring to children that you're going to put that kind of layering and challenge into Rubber Ducky.
I did an alphabet book for children called Jazz ABCs, and it had the biggest words in the world in it. And it goes through the ABCs, and it uses a different type of poem for each letter. Like some would be just free prose. Another one was a limerick. Another was a ballad and a pontoon. And I use different forms, and because I always love to hear little kids struggle to pronounce words that are bigger than the words they know. We need these 5 men to protect our building. You know, so I was imagining with that book just how important it is for us to always kind of have our kids reaching out in front of themselves and not feeling like a cell phone or something is going to teach them, and keeping them always striving for adulthood than having the other way around, having adults striving for childhood.
I want to pull one other piece of music that you've recently released. This is Swing Symphony, Movement Number 1, St. Louis to New Orleans. In listening to that piece, for me, it really felt like you were capturing the soul of a place. Can music do that?
Yeah, music can do that in many ways. It can be a specific thing that you equate with a sound, but then when there are no people who know what that place is, it can be a place in the human soul that is also equally as specific.
Let's look forward in the genre. I want to play a bit of a New Age jazz artist. This is Crowned and Kissed by Esperanza Spalding.
Heaven's down, don't even make a sound. Don't worry about a thing, I'm here to love you. My kisses are your crown, and I'm your queen. So now lay with me, my king, I'm here to love you.
What's your reaction to that?
You know, I like her. It's like sounds like an R&B song to me.
And how would you make the distinction? How do you make the distinction across these genres that seem to bleed together?
What the bass and drums play most of the time.
Can you explain that more? This is me asking. I'm so curious.
If the bass and drums are playing backbeat or groove-oriented music, punch, doodle-doom, chop, doodle-doom, doodle-doom, it's more like R&B. To me, that's not to say good or bad or to make a critique of her music at all. I'm critical of kind of larger cultural things, but I never critique a younger person's music. I'm merely describing what, to me, I listen to what bass and drums play, and they determine the style. Now, a musician can play a piece of jazz, a piece of R&B and jazz, or, you know, the pieces are all interchangeable, but most of the musicians, once they get to the kind of R&B grooves and the backbeat grooves, because that's what the public is most acclimated to hearing, they don't really go to anything swinging for too much.
Where do you think jazz is going next? What are you most excited about in
jazz? I'm excited about all the great young piano players that we have.
Any examples?
Like a young guy, Sean Mason, Joe Winhart, Miles Lennox, Joey Alexander, Isaiah Thompson, Micah Thomas, Robbie Lee. And whenever I hear them, I think, man, we have a lot of piano players out there that really can play and who are very, very serious. Those are the ones that I know and have heard, and I'm sure there are four or five other fantastic ones. And all of these, if you heard them play on a gig or something, they would blow your mind with the sophistication of their approach, the depth of their knowledge, their technical skills, their knowledge of jazz, and their willingness to play jazz.
How do you help get them introduced to the public? And maybe if you say the public's become most acclimated, for example, to the style of R&B, how do you bring them to these brilliant young piano players who have so much creativity to offer?
You know, it's very difficult. We do what we can at Jazz at Lincoln Center. We provide performances, and we do different things. We put them on the stage, but it's difficult because they're in a hard critical environment. And also, as younger people, who most of the people's tastes are formed by electronic music and backbeats and so on and so forth, that has become the definition of modern, and it tests their integrity. The arts will always put you in a challenging position, and it doesn't matter whether you're a younger musician today or if you're Haydn or Beethoven. They had questions of integrity that they had to face. Duke Ellington faced those questions. Louis Armstrong. Charlie Parker could have played like Louis Jordan, who did Ain't Nobody Here But Us Chickens. Charlie Parker made the choice to play in the style he played. It was not a popular style. So, you know, they too are faced with that choice. And I try to give them the strength to stretch their artistry and try to elevate the listening of their colleagues and not just follow their generation. However, I embrace them and love them regardless of the decisions they make. You know, I try to give them information and try to fortify them, but it's hard to accept not being popular or to not have a group that you want to like your music when you could just easily do something else that's less musically challenging but more socially satisfying.
With that in mind, for our young listeners who are aspiring musicians who may be hearing this, what piece of advice would you give them?
Stay in front of people. And don't feel like you have to play down to people. People will come with you. It takes longer. But also never forget about people when you're constructing your music. Because if you could get so deep into your thing and it's so myopic and self-absorbed, I don't know. Don't make it so hard for me to follow you that I'm not going to do that. Give me some way to follow you.
Jazz musician Wynton Marsalis, thank you so much for joining us here on Radio Boston.
Yes, ma'am. It's such a pleasure.
You can catch the Wynton Marsalis Quintet this Sunday, November 10th, at Boston Symphony Hall. You can find a link to tickets and more information on our website, radioboston.org. And that performance is presented by the Celebrity Series of Boston. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wolfman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.